Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Callum Borchers. It's Here and Now. Many residents in Jackson, Mississippi are in their third week without running water after winter storms last month froze the system and prompted city officials to issue boil water notices. The breakdown is a result of decades of neglect and lack of funding to repair a century-old infrastructure in Mississippi's capital city. Now the mayor is pleading with state and federal governments to help lift Jackson out of this crisis. And Jackson Mayor Chokwe Lumumba joins us now. Mayor Lumumba, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you, Callum. It's a pleasure to speak with you and to talk before your listening audience.
Pleasure to have you as well. And Mayor, I want to start by asking for an update because your city's Public Works Director, Charles Williams, said earlier in the week that about a quarter of Jackson's residents were still without running water. That's some 40,000 people. So what's the latest?
Well, there has been progress. The overwhelming majority of our residents have been able to have restoration of their water. But there are a few spots within South Jackson that are at higher elevations that are still having difficulty receiving the water. And our water treatment facility operates off of hydraulics. And that is why the PSI, which was interrupted during the winter weather, is so important to the function of our water treatment facility. And so as we're increasing the pressure, they're getting it. But most residents, even in South Jackson, have received water now. But we are still under a citywide boil water notice in which we have to wait on the health department to give us clearance to have two consecutive days of testing before we can lift that boil water notice. So the challenge is still immense because even with people having water, you still have those residents, and we're not satisfied until the very last resident has water. But even those who do have water, they can't consume it. And so it still makes it challenging for our elderly, those who are immobile, to get access to drinking water and water they can cook with.
And I know that for a temporary fix that city officials and the National Guard have been helping distribute water so that people can just do basic things like flush toilets. I know that also 25% of Jackson residents live in poverty, Mr. Mayor, and you've embraced being labeled a radical because you say that big systemic change is what we need to help the most vulnerable people. But I wonder how hard it is to go big when you're dealing with something as basic as running water.
Absolutely. Well, it's the resources and the lack thereof. And so we continue to make the case that this is necessary. And when we talk about the state of our economy, both locally and nationally, we have to be able to look at these sustainable development goals as a true barometer of the success and failure of our economy. We need to look at it in the frame of a dignity economy, which looks at whether people have access to fresh fruits and vegetables, whether people have access or the ability to have functioning and sufficient infrastructure to support them and the quality of education, instead of looking at GDP. These are the things that we need to be looking at in terms of whether we are meeting the needs of our residents and whether our economy is what it should be.
You know, a lot of people are calling this water crisis in Jackson an environmental and social justice issue. The city is 82% black and its revenue streams have dwindled over time. What do you see? Do you agree with that characterization?
I think that when we look at just city models and look at the equity questions and how resources are dispersed amongst communities, that those are definitely valid questions to raise. How is it that a city which is overwhelmingly black, the largest city in the state of Mississippi, could be, ostracized from the resources that it needs for such a prolonged period of time? As we look internally with the city of Jackson, some people have questions about, what communities are restored water before others. And it is based on the grid in which our pipes are laid out, in which the more affluent communities are closest to the water treatment facility. Therefore, they're the first to receive water when issues like this take place. And we have to realize that city design does not happen by mistake, that issues of equity and issues of justice now have to be incorporated in the models of what we think are the best ways to build our cities going forward.
In the moment we have left then, Mr. Mayor, I do want to ask you about your governor, Tate Reeves, who this week removed all of the state's COVID restrictions, including the mask mandate. And this is even as infections in Mississippi rose by 62% last week. So how are you handling things in Jackson?
Well, first and foremost, I see it as an irresponsible move at a moment where we can finally see a light at the end of the tunnel with the introduction of three vaccines. For us to be making this move prematurely when health experts are not only informing us locally but nationally, saying that with the introduction of new variants of this virus, that some people need to double mask up, and we certainly don't need to let our guard down now, that is just it makes little sense to me. And so, fortunately, in the city of Jackson, our requirement is that the governor's executive order serve as a minimal standard, and we can employ more stringent protocol, and we will be doing that in the city of Jackson.
That's Jackson, Mississippi Mayor Chokwe Lumumba. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
China is poised to take another step to tighten control over Hong Kong. The ruling Communist Party in Beijing outlined a plan today that would allow a largely pro-Beijing committee to choose a large part of Hong Kong's legislature. The same committee already picks the city's leader. CNN international correspondent Will Ripley joins us from Hong Kong now. He's on Skype. And Will, put this into context for us, because the pro-democracy movement was already threatened by the new security law that targeted activists.
Tanya, people are really uneasy, uncertain about what the future is going to hold for anybody who voices any sort of dissent here in Hong Kong, because ever since China passed this national security law and rounded up nearly all of the known pro-democracy politicians and activists, 47 of whom have now been charged in court after a grueling four-day proceeding in which six people were hospitalized because they were in there for so many hours, people are afraid. And you have that fear combined with the COVID-19 pandemic restrictions that have kept crowd sizes very minimal out on the streets. You're not seeing anything close to the protests that we saw in the summer of 2019 because they restrict gatherings of four or more. And then on top of that, you now have this news out of Beijing that basically the chief executive, who is handpicked by Beijing, will handpick who can run for office in Hong Kong. So in a very short period of time, what Beijing has essentially done is they're going to eliminate that pro-democracy voice that always had a voice in the Hong Kong Legislative Council. And for people who celebrated that unique quality of Hong Kong, that back and forth, that spirit of democracy, that now seems very dead to most people here.
Well, Beijing is saying there are loopholes in Hong Kong's electoral system that have allowed anti-China forces to undermine stability. Can you give us a reality check on that claim?
Beijing is claiming that by appointing, as they call, patriots to run for office here in Hong Kong, that lives up to one country, two systems, because it's Hong Kong people running Hong Kong. The problem is that the majority of Hong Kong people support the pro-democracy movement. And that was proven in the local elections in which pro-democracy parties, at the height of the protests, at the height of the disruption, where, you know, conceivably the populace could have turned against the protesters because it certainly causes a lot of gridlock here, but they overwhelmingly supported the pro-democracy parties, the parties which have now essentially been disbanded, members forced into exile, charged, or facing charges.
As you mentioned, the pandemic tamped down those protests, but what is the state of the pro-democracy movement overall in Hong Kong?
The only people who actually have a voice are those who are now living in other places, because everybody who's tied to the pro-democracy movement here in Hong Kong, just four of the 47 actually were granted bail. The remaining activists and politicians are being held for 3 months, 3 months without bail, to allow prosecutors time to go through their phones and their financial records to build these cases against them. And for the four people so far who have been granted bail, they can't give any speeches. They cannot participate in any elections other than to vote, which is kind of ironic considering who they would be voting for. And essentially, they've even had to kind of disavow themselves from the parties that they represented, stay quiet about the views that they were so passionate about. That is the reality for the pro-democracy movement inside Hong Kong. But those who are in exile are still speaking out on social media very strongly.
So what's next? I mean, if China takes more control of Hong Kong's legislature, doesn't the movement lose whatever grip overall, as loose as it may have been on the actual government and any ability in the bigger picture to fight for the things that they want?
I've lived in Hong Kong for 3 years, but I've been traveling in and out of this city for the past eight. To see the Hong Kong of today versus the Hong Kong that I fell in love with when I decided I wanted to move here, for me personally, it's a sad feeling. And that's a feeling shared, I think, by a lot of people who appreciated the unique beauty, the unique chaos of Hong Kong, because it was the one place in all of China's territory where there could be discourse, where there could be protests and color. And that all now seems to be fading away here. So that is that's the reality. In many ways, Hong Kong is now just like any other Chinese city, which is why you have seen it acts from, you know, the Heritage Foundation's Economic Freedom Index. Hong Kong used to be considered to have the freest economy in the world. It was overtaken by Singapore. Now it ranks 107th as part of China.
CNN international correspondent Will Ripley in Hong Kong. Will, thank you so much for this update.
Thanks, Tom.
It was already difficult for many Americans to find a mental health counselor before the pandemic, and now it's even harder. There's a shortage of counselors to meet the rising demand to treat conditions like depression and anxiety. Almost a third of therapists are seeing more patients, according to a survey last fall by the American Psychological Association, and many are turning away patients because they're booked up. Tamara Farabee is seeing these challenges firsthand. She's Executive Director of Human Services Administration at the National Association of Black Counselors. She's also a licensed professional counselor in Chester, Virginia. Tamara, welcome.
Hi, how are you? I'm glad to be here.
I'm glad to have you, and I'm wondering how you would describe the current need for mental health counselors overall in this country, and how are therapists trying to meet that need right now?
Overall, I would describe it as being critical. Going to virtual was difficult. Working with the insurance companies during this time has been confusing and difficult. And having patients that are constantly calling, constantly trying to get on your caseload. Your caseload is about typically for a full-time counselor, about 25 patients a week. And I mean, I know that many of my colleagues are exceeding that. We are inundated right now. We can't even keep up with the phone calls to the office. And so we are, you know, actively reaching out and trying to find out who has openings, when, and it's pretty rough out here right now.
And Tamara, are you and your fellow Black therapists feeling the squeeze even more so? Because we know that before the pandemic began, there were already disproportionately fewer Black counselors to go around.
Yes, I really think that finding a Black therapist is particularly difficult when you come out of the South and when you come out of urban areas. So, yes, all of us are feeling the squeeze. All of us are inundated. It's been a very challenging time.
And to the extent you can, while respecting patient privacy, I would love to hear some of the stories about your patients. What are they coming to you with right now?
Many of my patients are having a difficult time with this transition period. So the bottom line is everything in life that they're doing in their life now has changed and has to be done differently. From parenting their kids to how their job is done, everything has changed. So what I'm seeing is a definite rise and increase in anxiety. I'm seeing people that are having more marital conflicts, more conflicts with their children, with their adult children coming home from college. You know, I'm having definitely more patients call me, and they're in the middle of a mental health crisis at that moment. I'm having many patients call me, and they're actively in panic attacks and experiencing all kinds of issues. Like, I've had a couple of them, the ambulance had to come get them. Their panic attack was so bad. There's been an increase in the medication that they've had to take. So it's been challenging for a lot of people. A lot of people are really struggling right now.
That must be so alarming for you, because I imagine that at baseline, your work is predominantly appointments. It's pre-scheduled. It's not that immediate emergency phone call, but you're getting more of those.
Yeah, it's different. It's definitely different. It's not surprising, though. I think I kind of expected it.
So, Tamara, I mean, these are some of the acute problems that you're seeing during the pandemic. I'm curious about what you foresee after the fact, because I know that some governing bodies have, to address the increased need, loosen some of the licensing requirements. But it's not clear that that's going to be a permanent change. And in ordinary times, there's a lot of hurdles to clear to become a therapist. So what does the pipeline look like?
Well, we do have a lot of challenges. I think coming into this COVID crisis, counselors, therapists, social workers, all of us, the COVID pandemic hit a mental health system that was already weak. So the mental health system in this country needs a lot more funding. It needs a lot more attention. We need a lot more mental health beds. We need a whole lot of things to shore up and strengthen the mental health system in this country. You know, they tend to want to bring counselors out when there is some sort of crisis, when there's been a mass killing and all of that thing. You know, you always hear, oh, we're bringing on the counselors now. But there's very little in terms of prevention and continual treatment. There are always issues. So we have a lot. The government is really going to have to respond and help states to make this a priority, especially now after COVID.
Tamara Farabee is Executive Director of Human Services Administration at the National Association of Black Counselors. She's also a licensed professional counselor in Chester, Virginia. Tamara, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you so much.
Okay, so here's a sobering reality for young people and mental health. The National School Counselor Association recommends schools have one counselor for every 250 students, but many states do not meet this threshold. In Arizona, for example, on average, there's only one school counselor for every 900 students. Joining us now is Shiloh Wheeler, who is a school counselor for the Thatcher Unified School District in Thatcher, Arizona. And she's also a past chair of the Arizona School Counselors Association. Shiloh, I know your days are really busy, so thank you for being here.
Thank you very much for having me.
Your district is in a rural area about 2 hours southeast of Phoenix. It's K through 12. And there's only you and one other counselor to meet the needs of 1,700 students. How are you managing that load?
That's correct. I feel like my load's been cut in half. We just barely last year hired a second counselor. So for the first several years, I was by myself. But it's a lot to manage. It is putting out crisis after crisis, fire after fire. I would say our district's been fortunate because we are committed to the health and well-being, mental health and social health of our students. So we have been one of the few schools in Arizona and probably throughout the country that have been in person this entire school year. But even being in person, we've seen increases in uncertainty. There seems to be an elevated level of stress. Kids have turned out that towards the end of the semester are a little more apathetic, not really caring a lot about things that they used to really care about or things that used to be important to them. So it's still challenging for our students throughout the pandemic.
And I can imagine challenging for you because you're helping them chart their course. You're there to help them have a successful school year.
Mm-hmm, definitely. And while we do have most of our kids in person, we still have a handful that are doing a remote learning, so they're not in person. And so trying to get these kids to be more motivated or more excited about a future that seems really uncertain to them is challenging.
There's also something else. You all were, as you said, you've been having in-person school all of this school year. But right after the pandemic, the students were sent home and school went virtual. What are some of the challenges that you also experienced helping them just navigate virtual school? Because I'm thinking back to my days in school. Counselors were there as a shoulder to go to cry on, but they also were there to kind of help you manage your classes and different types of challenges that you deal with throughout the day.
Exactly. When we closed, just like everybody else around the country, about this time last year, our schools closed for the rest of the year. And so making a quick shift to being a virtual counselor was difficult. You realize how much you rely on visual cues or friends that kind of give you a heads up of how their friends are doing. Students obviously are not excited about talking on the phone or they don't check their email. And so there are limited ways to reach out to students. So we had to try various methods, whether through Google Meets or through Zoom calls or through messages and surveys we'd send out to our students, trying to reach out to those kids to see how they were. But it was hard to really get a grasp on how students were doing. And even the students who you thought would be doing well or had lots of support at home, you know, after the first month, were telling me that they were really struggling. It was hard for them to be alone. They felt isolated. So we really did have a lot of students struggling while we weren't in school.
And we just heard from our previous guest who was talking with Callum about how adults are also dealing with anxiety and feeling really emotional and out of control. I mean, how can people in power, like school administrators and state leaders, help support you in your work to really maintain your students' emotional health?
Yeah, we are working super hard, especially within Arizona, to decrease our ratio to make sure we have more school counselors within the schools so that they can support our students. And that support also reaches out and branches out to our parents as well as we work with families.
Mm. How can parents help you help their kids?
I think it's important that parents are aware of what's going on with their kids, checking in with their students a little bit more, especially in the older grades where they can hide it a little bit easier, or maybe it's normal when you're in virtual learning mode. Kids will spend a lot of time in their room, so it may seem normal, but they may not be okay. And I think just that partnership of parents feeling like they can reach out to the school counselors to have a conversation about what they're seeing or what concerns, or to talk about strategies or things that they'll be able to use to help their kids or to recognize warning signs for things that might be more serious.
Well, Shiloh, thank you so much for your work and talking with us.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure.
Shiloh Wheeler is a school counselor for the Thatcher Unified School District in Thatcher, Arizona. She's also a past chair of the Arizona School Counselors Association.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
When the survivors of a mass shooting at a newspaper went back to work, everything was different, even email.
What if someone's sending us more death threats? Or what if somebody sends me a death threat and I don't see it, and then somebody comes and kills all my friends and it's my fault because I didn't read the email?
That's this week on the Capital Gazette series from NPR's Embedded.
Now we're seeing an uptick in the jobs market. Business owners are feeling more confident now that the COVID-19 vaccine is becoming more widely available. The Labor Department reported today that employers added 379,000 jobs in February, mostly in sectors hit hard by the pandemic like bars and restaurants and hotels. But there is still about 10 million fewer jobs compared to a year ago. Let's bring in Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Hey, Ali.
Hi, Tanya.
So this jobs report exceeded expectations. What were the biggest gains?
Well, exceeded by a lot. And as you said, they tended to be in the leisure and hospitality sector, hotels, museums, resorts, amusement parks, restaurants. Of the 379,000 net new jobs added in February, 355,000 were in those categories. And when you subdivide that even further, food service itself was the vast majority of those gains, 285,000. So of all the gains we were expecting in February, we exceeded it by a lot, and more than the total anticipated number were just in food services. So that, you know, you're hearing around the country some restrictions being let up, some museums opening, some restaurants opening, and bars in places where they were closed with minimum number of people allowed, and that's what you're seeing reflected in this job creation.
Interesting. Another thing we're seeing is manufacturing activity is also at a three-year high, but that sector only added about 21,000 jobs last month. Why are manufacturers lagging behind the pace of demand?
Well, it's because manufacturing is costly. So if you a year ago or 6 months ago thought that this was going to be something that was going to be a long-term shutdown, a lot of workers, manufacturing workers cut, or a lot of manufacturing plants and employers cut their workers to preserve cash during the initial months. What we saw is that a lot of people quit the labor force last year because of those concerns. So we're now seeing, with a, I guess we could call it a light at the end of the tunnel, a number of these manufacturers getting back online and saying, let's get our factories going, let's get our people back in a safe way and try to prepare for sort of a comeback? Because there's a lot of speculation that the comeback might be very strong because of pent-up consumer demand, things that they haven't been spending on and doing in the last year, they may start to do once people start to emerge back into society.
Okay, so I'm sorry in advance, Allie. The question I'm about to ask you right now is a big one, but only 61% of the labor force is actually contributing to the economy right now. What do you think it's going to take to help more people return to the workforce?
So that's a really
good
question.
In light of the pandemic.
Yeah, because people think that with, you know, if we've got 6% unemployment, that must mean 93% of, you know, 94% of people are working. And that's not true. We're usually only ever in the 60s, the labor force, because there's some people who can work but choose not to or went back to school or are raising a family, that sort of thing. But this number, 61%, is substantially lower than it has been historically. We are going to need to see sort of a more wholesale opening up of society when that's deemed to be safe in order to see more people going in. Until then, we are not likely to see even in the mid 60% of available people working. But remember, even when we are at normal, we never exceed sort of the high 60s. A lot of people don't work for lots of other reasons. So we won't see that number recover for a while.
Allie Velshi is MSNBC, an MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. As always, thank you so much and have a good weekend.
Thank you, Tanya.
The political pressure on New York's Democratic Governor Andrew Cuomo is growing. A new report shows his administration concealed the number of COVID-19 deaths in nursing homes, and he's facing three accusations of sexual harassment and misconduct. This week, New York Attorney General Letitia James opened an independent investigation into those allegations. Cuomo has rejected calls for his resignation, though we've seen many powerful men lose their jobs during the Me Too movement, which has changed the way we think about power and accountability for sexual harassment and bad behavior. Let's look at how that shift is shaping the response to the allegations against Cuomo. We're joined on Skype by Jill Filipovich, who writes about politics, women's rights, and the law. Jill, welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks so much for having me.
Glad to have you, and I'm wondering how you see the Cuomo episode playing out in the context of the Me Too movement.
I think the most important thing we're seeing about how the Cuomo story is playing out is this investigation headed up by Letitia James. I think one thing that especially Democratic voters seemed quite frustrated by when Al Franken was pushed out of the Senate, I personally think rightly, was the lack of a fair process. And I think as the Me Too movement gets more sophisticated and grows, and as we see it take kind of clearer shape, it is really important to have fair, consistent processes so that we can really get to the root of how these harassment allegations came about, whether they're true, and what's the whole system behind them. I think what we've seen is that this is almost never a case of a single man behaving badly. It's often a whole system that enables for him and covers up for him. And the importance of an investigation is to really tell that whole story and show us the whole ecosystem.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned the whole system because, as you mentioned, Letitia James heading up this investigation, she, of course, replaced Eric Schneiderman, who himself was accused of sexual abuse in his personal life and resigned from his position as attorney general in 2018. So imagine if he were still in office and in charge of overseeing this investigation of the governor. I mean, would people have any faith in that process?
Well, that's such an important point. And I think one of the arguments, you know, in favor of a robust and continuing Me Too movement is exactly this, that when we have men in charge of our most important institutions, whether those are political, legal, or cultural, and those same men are engaging in sexual harassment or even worse, sexual assault, that shapes whether or not we hold other men accountable. It shapes the kind of stories that we tell and that we hear about women, about power, about sex, about work. And so that part of the importance of Me Too is not just to look at sexual harassment and sexual assault as these kind of individual bad acts, but to look at them in the whole context of our society and our culture, and to look at them as violations of power, not just as sexual acts.
So that theme of power was a real focus of an appearance last night by Charlotte Bennett, one of the governor's accusers. She was on the CBS Evening News with Nora O'Donnell, and she described a conversation that she had with Cuomo in his office about intimate relationships. And she says that he told her he was open to dating anyone over 22. The governor is 63, by the way. Bennett also says Cuomo told her that he wanted a girlfriend and was lonely. Let's listen to part of that interview.
I feel like people put the onus on the woman to shut that conversation down. And by answering, I was somehow engaging in that or enabling it, when in fact I was just terrified.
So Jill, Charlotte Bennett says she was deeply uncomfortable in that conversation, but she didn't feel like she could stop it or leave it because Cuomo is her boss. I mean, he is a very powerful person. So expand on this idea of power imbalances in these sexual harassment situations.
This is really what's at the heart of so many sexual harassment claims. In Charlotte Bennett's case, you know, she is not in a position to be able to shut that conversation down, even if she wants to, because the person who is pushing her into that conversation is in charge of whether or not she moves up the ladder in that workplace. So she's stuck in this position where, by even having a highly sexualized conversation, she's already being treated differently. She knows right in that moment that she's not being evaluated on the same terms as her male colleagues. And then on the other hand, if she pushes back on that, right, she knows that she could see some penalties from her boss. It may be along the lines of, now her boss thinks that she's, you know, not a team player. She has a bad attitude. She can't take a joke. And when we hear Cuomo responding to these allegations, I mean, that's kind of what he's poking at, right? He's saying that he was just joking. He's just kind of a laid back, you know, laughy guy in the office. So it's not just about the harassment. It's about how it impacts your ability to move up the ranks in your workplace, your ability to do your job, and your ability and the ability of women generally to be evaluated for their competence and their work product rather than, you know, their sexuality and, frankly, their tolerance for sexualized and inappropriate jokes.
You know, one of the things that has come out of the Me Too movement in recent years is there are tighter policies in place in a lot of different workplaces. And in the governor's office, there are rules against sexual harassment. The governor says he supports them, and yet it appears that they don't always stop harassment from happening or even cause it to be investigated or addressed right away. So how effective are these workplace policies, Jill? I mean, do they have enough teeth?
You know, it's incredibly hard to evaluate how effective these workplace policies are. I think what we do know is that it's really important to have policies that are clear, that everyone understands, that are enforced consistently and fairly. You know, it's easy to say, don't sexually harass people, right? I think most employees would agree that that's like a pretty good and fair rule. But it needs to be explicit what that means. It needs to be explicit what happens if there is a complaint made. There need to be really clear reporting processes. And all of this needs to be quite transparent. So, you know, on both sides, someone who's filing a complaint about sexual harassment needs to understand on the front end, who knows that they're filing? Who's entitled to that information? What does an investigation look like? What are the potential penalties? And same for a person who has a complaint filed against them. And I think, unfortunately, in a lot of workplaces, you know, a lot of it is kind of ad hoc and whatever an HR department decides to do, and is often done in the favor of protecting a company, not necessarily protecting and advocating for employees who have been sexually harassed. So I do think there's still a lot of work to be done, and it's not all going to happen just through sexual harassment training videos. A lot of this does need to be focused on, what does an investigation look like? What are the processes involved?
Well, and just to widen the lens from Cuomo for a moment, I mean, this week we also saw an inspector general's report that found Ronny Jackson sexually harassed women when he was the top White House doctor. Louisiana State University released a report that found football coach Les Miles had inappropriate interactions with female students. I mean, these behaviors were known years ago, and yet since then, Jackson has been elected to Congress, and Miles has gotten a new job at the University of Kansas. So, Jill, where do things stand when it comes to accountability?
We're not there yet. Sexual harassment, sexism generally, is unfortunately incredibly pervasive. And I think, unfortunately, we're seeing kind of a widening partisan gap here on this issue. men across the political spectrum, and some women too, right, can and do engage in sexual harassment. So sexual harassment itself is not a partisan issue, but the response to sexual harassment and to sexism generally does seem to be taking on a bit of a partisan flavor. Democrats certainly are very, very far from perfect. But unfortunately, with Republicans, sexual harassment and even allegations of sexual assault don't seem to be disqualifying in any way. And I think part of, you know, their strategy has been to really hit Democrats on sexual harassment, but then refuse to hold their own team accountable, which now I think is fueling this reaction from Democrats, you know, of some, not all, but some folks who I would say are a bit more cynical, saying, well, you know, if they're just going to use this against us, why are we falling for this trap? Why are we doing it? You know, and I would say that it's crucial to root out sexual harassment and assault wherever it happens, even if it's from someone, you know, on your quote unquote team. But it is frustrating to see that this has taken on a quite cynical and quite partisan flavor to it.
Well, as you mentioned, some of the Democrats who came out so strongly against Al Franken a few years ago are more measured in their response to Andrew Cuomo now, perhaps because they saw Republicans not holding their team to the same standard, and now Democrats don't want to unilaterally disarm. That's Jill Filipovich. She writes about politics, women's rights, and the law. Jill, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Reaction was swift this week to Texas Governor Greg Abbott's announcement that the state was lifting its mask mandate. President Biden weighed in, calling Texas and Mississippi's decision to lift the mandates Neanderthal thinking. And there were a lot of strong opinions that also went viral on Twitter. Let's turn now to Femi Oke, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Welcome, Femi.
Hello there, Tonya. A lot of texts on social media this week. You could say that Governor Greg Abbott was flexing his social influencer muscles, Tonya.
Oh my gosh, what are people saying about this online?
So this was the tweet that got everybody started, fired up. Instant feedback online. For instance, Congresswoman Lauren Boebert, God bless Texas. Now, I know you know this, Tonya, sometimes you can't always tell if something that's posted on social is sarcastic or ironic.
Right,
I don't believe that line was. I think that was absolutely genuine. This, though, is sarcasm from Jonathan Jewell. Congrats to the Texas funeral industry. You are going to be a real busy RIP Texas. But the real concern amongst all of the back and forth about Texas, what is wrong with you? But Alex Fetsky says, how about you go live in your dungeon at home by yourself and stay safe? Let the rest of us take our own risk for our own lives. Tonya.
There are so many reactions to this. I mean, now people are using hashtags to articulate a bigger message. There's I hate it here hashtag referring to living in Texas, and then vote him out referring to Governor Abbott. What are some of the other calls to action you're seeing?
So dueling hashtags here. So there's the anti-governor hashtags and then the pro-governor hashtags. Open Texas, hashtag Open Texas. The business people of Texas, and many of them are very happy, very excited. And also hashtag Texas Independence Day. Again, excitement from the Texans who are so over the mask mandate and ready to mingle.
Okay, there's another story you're following, Femi. The trial of Derek Chauvin begins on Monday in Minneapolis. He's the former police officer charged in George Floyd's death last summer. And we're reading that the city turned to social media influencers to spread approved messages during the trial. What is this program exactly, and what's been the response?
So this stopped me scrolling, Tonya, this story, and it's almost like doing a double take when you're online. So the Minneapolis city website has contracts out for community organizers, but digging deeper, you can find that what they were looking for were social media influencers. They had a budget of $12,000, and the idea was to reach communities that don't use traditional media. And the idea was also to curb misinformation, social media engagement, but the engagement would have to be approved. That doesn't really work. So there was a lot of pushback. Josh Cobb, for instance, says, this is the plan. City of Minneapolis says the plan is to pay social media influencers to push out messaging during the trial. Six messengers, not named, they were going to be paid $2,000 each. It didn't last very long. Within days, Minneapolis decided that it was a bad idea, and they're trying to gain back respect from the very communities they were trying to reach out to.
Wow. Okay, before I let you go,
Dolly Parton. She received her first dose of the Moderna vaccine. Yes, it's a vaccine that she actually helped fund, and she documented her experience on Twitter with a modified rendition of Jolene. Let's listen.
And I wanted to tell everybody, I think you should get out there and do it too. I even changed one of my songs to fit the occasion. It goes, vaccine, 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 vaccine. I'm begging of you, please don't hesitate. Vaccine,
that's a hit already.
It's already a hit. Femi, I watched the reactions to this too. So much love for the most part for Dolly Parton.
Yeah, you say for the most part. Carolyn, for instance, says, Dolly, you're a powerful person. You must know the agenda behind this vaccine. I'm so shocked and disappointed that you're promoting it. Carolyn was in the minority, though, because most people were delighted. You twice declined the Presidential Medal of Freedom during this hard time. Post another. You refused to let a statue be erected of you in the middle of a pandemic. You donated $1 million to help save America from the ravages of COVID. You are a legend. I will always love you. Get it? Isn't that a beautiful post?
What a perfect post, yes. And then there's lots of talk about the actual shirt she wore, right?
Oh, my goodness. Bringing back the cold shoulder dress where you've got the little cutouts on your arms, and Dolly wore it in style. Take a look online at Dolly Parton. You'll be able to see her in all her glory if you haven't already.
Now we understand what that shirt is for. I always wondered about that style. That's Femi Okeh, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too. Take care, everybody.
And a moment now to say thank you and goodbye to one of our producers, Christina Kim. Christina and I started at Here and Now a year and a half ago, both of us based here in Los Angeles. She has been my right hand, the other half of my brain in many ways, bringing a wealth of depth and context to the most important stories of our time. Conversations about immigration, housing and homelessness, the pandemic and issues of social justice and racial equity. Our loss is Southern California's gain. Christina is becoming a reporter for member station KPBS in San Diego. Thank you for everything, Christina. And we can't wait to bring your reporting to the show. And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Callum Borchers. It's Here and Now.